This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about politics as a factor in mental health. Right now, we're in a particularly divisive time in UK politics, and unfortunately, many areas of mental health support really need addressing. Before we get into that, just a quick disclaimer, it is just me on today's intro. Annie is away on other projects, but don't worry, I have just as many stats and hopefully as much insight as usual. First up, one from the BBC, and they looked into how much the NHS does versus how much it spends around mental health activity. So NHS activity relating to mental health was 23%, whereas the budget for mental health related activity was only 11%. So I thought this was a really good example of how much this particular service is stretched in terms of the resources. No doubt this will in many cases include nurses, doctors, other mental health professionals working unpaid overtime or seeing more patients than they should be seeing, having people that don't have enough beds available but are still being treated in the hospital, which ideally should never happen. There'll be a whole load of combinations that go into how they're able to stretch just 11% of the budget to 23% of activity. Also, this doesn't include many cases where mental health problems are treated as a secondary cause of hospital admission. This is only when the primary cause of them going into hospital is a mental health condition. That's hopefully a quick and straightforward example of how much resources could be diverted more to mental health to meet the demand that's clearly already there. Next up, from the National Centre of Social Research, they asked 5,000 adults about their experience of mental health and found those living in low-income households were far more likely to be diagnosed with mental illness than those in high-income households. So the study found 27% of men and 42% of women in the lowest income 20% of households, compared to 15% of men and 25% of women in the highest 20% of income households, are dealing with a mental health condition currently. So that's staggering, just how looking at this single factor, the income of the household, has such an effect on people reporting dealing with mental illness. It's also important to note with this episode talking about politics, because those in the lowest incomes that are being most affected are also the ones that aren't going to have access to things like private counselling. The affordability of such services are just not going to be there. And so again, it will fall in many cases on charities to provide free support where the current government-provided resources are lacking in certain areas. This is one that I personally feel very lucky on, in that I have private counselling myself. I know that that's a privilege, but as someone who comes from having two parents that work for the NHS, prior to going for private counselling, I never would have dreamed of going for anything private. I would always go to the NHS. However, it's one of these cases where to get the support, in many cases you have to, whether the waiting lists are too long or you're not even put on the waiting list unless you're considered extremely at risk. Equally, many of the specialist types of counselling like DBT, which are really suitable for conditions like PTSD or borderline personality disorder, the waiting lists for these are even longer. And so again, often people find they have to go private if they can, or go to other services like charities just to get that support at all. The last two stats I wanted to mention are from Bipolar UK and relate as well to content covered in the episode. So first off, just 21% of people with a long-term mental health condition are in employment. So This is referring to bipolar as the status from Bipolar UK. This is something that I wanted to highlight, as in the episode we talk about the homelessness problem and just how many people in a homeless situation are partly there because of mental health problems. So when it comes to becoming homeless, of course, being unemployed can be a clear factor in how that situation comes about. The last statistic, again from Bipolar UK, is that bipolar increases the risk of suicide by 20 times. In the episode, we do talk to some extent about suicide, and bipolar is something that our guest experiences and has felt suicidal many times in the past. So that's just, again, something to highlight how this particular condition can put you so at risk. And so the support is needed across the board. But with the example of the guest, she needed support and didn't in many cases get it. But actually that's extra concerning when you consider the condition she has and the risks that poses. So we'll get into the episode shortly. It is an incredibly sobering one. We normally don't get as political on the podcast. This one, being a politics episode, is very much no holds barred. If after listening to this episode, you do want to go away and do something positive to try and make a difference, you can of course sign our petition for mental health education to be added to the curriculum in all UK schools, if you haven't done so already. So to join the over 190,000 people that have signed so far, visit bit.ly/mentalpetition. That link will also be in the episode description. So we'll get into the interview with our wonderful guest, Samantha Presti, shortly. She's a brilliant comedian, star of several upcoming one-woman shows, which she'll tell us all about at the end of the episode. We'll get into the interview in just a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Samantha Presti. I am diagnosed with bipolar. I've been diagnosed since my early 20s. Before that, I had a couple of episodes of depression. Didn't really know what it was the first time. People think, oh, someone's lazy, they don't come on time, they can't get out of bed, they've not put themselves together very well. So back when I was a teenager, there wasn't really much awareness of depression or mental health issues. Got diagnosed with bipolar when I was hospitalised in my 20s with my first psychotic episode. And then I ended up being okay for about 7 years until my dad got really sick. He had dementia and he was dying. So I'd built a life in London, had a flat, had a job, had to give it all up, go home, care for him on his deathbed, which was really traumatic because the hospital was short-staffed and he wasn't getting his needs met. And after that, I started to become quite unwell. And I was already diagnosed with bipolar, but with that in mind, my family couldn't actually find any support for me in the local community because I wasn't already under secondary care. And the only person that my mum could find for me to talk to at that time was the local vicar, and that didn't go well because she found out I read tarot cards and she didn't like that. I think she thought I was possessed. But it wasn't until I got so poorly that I had to be sectioned that I got the help that I needed. And, well, say needed, I didn't really need to be locked in a police cell for 2 days while I waited for a bed to become available. And then I got transferred to a private hospital because I think back then they were only allowed to keep you there for 2 days in the police cell before being put in a hospital closer to home, which was lucky as well because that doesn't always happen. And I was in there for a month, and again they said, oh, okay, you're bipolar, you're going to be on medication for the rest of your life, you should consider yourself disabled, you don't need to work, you don't need to drive. And I found the whole experience quite disempowering, really, because I wasn't given any choices. But I chose not to listen to that one psychiatrist opinion that said that stuff to me. And I have rebuilt my life since, and I do work and I do drive and I'm okay again, mostly. But it's been a constant struggle to get my needs met from the state. I was very lucky to get psychological therapy on the NHS, but obviously people have to wait for that. And I live quite a full life, but it does get in the way sometimes still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot even just to hear all that you've been through back to back like that. In particular, you spending time in a police cell because there wasn't any beds available.
Yeah.
It's really upsetting, particularly when we're brought up to think that's the worst place you can be, like you've done something bad and then you get put in a police cell. So did you find you were thinking similar things when you were put in there?
I was in psychosis, so I was doing the can-can in there. I was singing, I was seeing these illusions on the wall. So I didn't know that I was in a police cell. I thought that I was locked in the Titanic and it was sinking. So it was very traumatizing, you know. There was no one there to talk to me. They'd open the little flap occasionally and I think I got a dinner. But I feel that was probably more traumatizing than the experience of going into psychosis itself. It was terrifying.
It's just not at all geared for supporting someone in that situation. And so often where there's shortages of other services, the police end up stepping in and they're, you know, they're there to prevent crime and you hadn't committed any.
No, and yeah, you do feel like you've done something wrong. I remember, well, I've been told, I don't remember much of the actual breakdown, but there was an ambulance that came and a police car and they argued over who to take me, and the ambulance were like, maybe she's drunk, and of course my family were like, no, she's not drunk, she's been to a funeral. It happened at my uncle's funeral, which makes it even worse. But the ambulance hadn't got a place for me, and it's only recently that they've stopped being allowed to do this to kids. They used to put kids in police cells, and I know they're trying, that they've got these triage teams now where the police will have a mental health nurse with them and I think a social worker, but they're not always available because of the government cuts. Police is being cut, things from the NHS is being cut, community prevention services are being cut. It's not fair, really, that austerity is disproportionately affecting the vulnerable and minorities and people with disabilities.
Yeah, and it often feels like when you see good progress, like them not putting kids in police cells and those kind of situations, but then there's cuts to other services. So it's like, well, where are the kids going to go if the NHS has had cuts and they don't have a bed? And it's crazy to think that in situations like you went through, they sent an ambulance team out with no availability of them bringing you back. So it was up to those unfortunate paramedics to deal with the situation there, which was never going to happen. So they're really set up to fail.
Another thing is you feel like a burden. I had to report a crime recently. It was actually someone attacking me on the basis of my disability, which is now classed as a hate crime. But you feel like a burden when the police are so short-staffed, and yes, there's knife crime, but all crime should be important. It shouldn't be a hierarchy of who deserves justice. It's just so annoying.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to actually work for the police, and part of that role was dealing with those incoming cases and doing initial investigations. And the longer I was there, the more clear it was becoming that they were trying to find as many ways as possible to get round actually dealing with some issues. Mm-hmm. So while I was there, we were reducing the amount of burglaries officers attended. And of course, that's one of the most traumatic things people can go through. Oh. Can threaten their whole feeling of safety in their own homes, which is meant to be where they feel safest. But they were trying to get us to investigate in ways that didn't involve sending officers. And that was part of the reason why I left, because whilst that was very much a reflection of cuts, not the officers not wanting to do the job, just there not being enough of them to get everything done, I was really struggling with my own ethics to feel comfortable being a part of it.
Oh, yeah, and I can imagine that then those people that are not getting their safety needs kind of met by a strong enough response from the police, they could then develop anxiety, and there's more pressure on other public services like the NHS.
Exactly, and that's where you get these clear links, because someone who even has had no experience of mental illness can have something traumatic, like crime, happen to them, and that could trigger PTSD.
Yeah.
And we often don't think of that. We think of PTSD in like war veterans or, you know, sometimes in things like car crashes, but there's actually a lot of crime that it comes from.
Yeah.
And sometimes all it takes is, for example, with a burglary, an officer going round, giving advice on how to add additional locks, going and doing door-to-door inquiries with neighbours. These small things can really help reassure somebody.
Exactly. And when you've been sectioned by the police, it's not very easy to trust them. I waited until I absolutely had to report that crime before I did, because I was so scared of the police. And then they took it seriously, but I ended up having to go to the headquarters, not quite far from here, and make a complaint about how it was dealt with. Because something like that, attacking someone for having a mental health issue, or another hate crime, like attacking someone for the colour of their skin, it is traumatic. And if that's not dealt with in a just way, it triggers more illness. I couldn't go on stage for a couple of months after all that stuff happened because I was scared for my safety. Do you want me to tell you what happened?
Yeah, do you mind sharing that?
So I had like a stalker, kind of. Someone was like completely obsessed with me, and I don't know for sure if the stalker and what happened is connected, because the police did investigate what happened. And what happened was, is someone made a fake Twitter account with my picture, my name, but the location was listed as in a mental institute, and in the bio it said deluded Sammy crybaby, things like that. But it also had a picture of my friend who had died the year before from mental health problems.
That was in the profile picture, in the banner.
It it said, because I read tarot cards, it said, talk to psychic Sam, I've been dead ages, and she talks to me all the time. And then it had all these videos of me, little snippets of me. I'd been crying on Facebook Live because of the stalker. And there were all these little snippets taken out of context. And they'd followed my workplace. They'd followed all the campaigns that I was involved in, people that I knew through activism, basically everything and everyone I cared about, this account had followed. So it was designed to be the ultimate humiliation, but they were not just making fun of me as a person or as a comedian, they were making fun of me specifically because I had a mental health issue, and they were using a picture of my friend who I'd written a show about that summer to taunt me as well. It was so traumatic.
That's so horrific.
So scary. And at that point I called 999 because I thought, how could someone be so hateful and so cruel? I thought someone must really, really want to hurt me. So they were trying to destroy my livelihood by contacting my employers and stuff. It was so scary. But the police did take it seriously. They did put in their request to Twitter for the data behind the account, but because Twitter is an American company, they didn't have to comply with UK law, and we never got the data. So we never found out who was behind it, but, you know, I can only speculate.
That's so sad, particularly when they have that kind of information available. And I don't even know how they would solve something like that. I can't help but I feel like for once I'm actually allowed to talk about it on the podcast, because we're actually having a politics episode. But I can't help but feel in these Brexity times, this is yet another example of why we need strong links between different countries.
Yeah.
Because surely there must be a way to create parity. Because I'm sure if it, you know, if you were American but living over here, I'm sure the American authorities would have far more power.
Maybe, yeah. And yeah, then there's the issue of like the human rights laws. And anyone with a disability could argue that under this climate of austerity, our human rights have already been violated because we're not being treated fairly, we're not being given equal opportunities. Being locked in a police cell was pretty degrading.
Mm.
And I think it was found, wasn't it? I read this in The Guardian. Oh, sorry, that's going to pick up on the podcast. I read this in The Guardian that they have sort of found that the UK is in breach of its human rights agreement, specifically towards disabled people and other groups like ethnic minorities and also women.
Mm, absolutely. Well, that's it when it comes to the social support services. It's not that the government are just doing those out of the good of their heart on a whim. It's laws that have been put in place to protect those that need the most support in our society.
Yeah.
And so when they don't give the services that the government itself has created, they're violating their own laws, and that's what's so mental about it.
Yeah, and they didn't need to make the choices that they've made. They are policy decisions that austerity has fallen a lot on the vulnerable in this country, because in Scotland they've made different choices. So specifically in England, people with disabilities, vulnerable groups, have experienced more of the austerity cuts. And you see it all the time, like in Walsall Council, where I live, they've still got to make 20 million cuts in the next year. And that's a Tory council, but Mike Bird, the leader of the Tory council, has even sort of spoken out against Theresa May, saying austerity is over. It's clearly not, not when they're making cuts to vital services. Like in Warsaw, they've just cut personal alarms. So disabled people and pensioners will rely on alarms for help if they fall or if they have an emergency, and now they've got to pay for that themselves. And I have a personal budget for social care. It's always been paid for by Walsall Council, but it was my CPN that did the needs assessment to give me I call it like pocket money from the council.
And if the listeners don't know what that abbreviation is, it's a community psychiatric nurse.
Yes, right? Yes. So my CPN did this assessment, found out that I had eligible needs, so then the state has a statutory right.
A responsibility.
Yeah, to meet eligible needs. So I've had my needs met for the last couple of years through the personal budget for social care, also known as direct payments. But it's part of Walsall's effort to try and save money that they are now reassessing people with these budgets, and they've switched the needs assessment from my community psychiatric nurse now to a social worker. So I had a social worker that I'd never met in my life come to my house to assess my needs, and she didn't understand me, and she tried to take it all away and just give me a support worker. Just everything just gone. And I'm now sort of having to fight Walsall Council to keep this money. So I had another social worker come out, and she found that I had got eligible needs. So yes, they have to meet the needs, but they don't seem to want to let me have my needs met in the way that's worked for me and kept me well over the last couple of years. They trying to signpost me to other things in the community, but it's all been cut. Where are they going to send me? And everyone's needs are different. So I think personalisation is a really, really good thing, but they seem to be trying to get rid of that now as well.
Right, it seems like so often the government expect charities to step in and give these support services. I used to work for Samaritans, and the amount of times we had people refer to the organisation, sometimes in incredibly unprofessional ways, like we'd have other support services that didn't have the capacity to deal with someone's concern, tried to forward the responsibility.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, isn't there?
And they just expect, oh, because you're a charity, because you're made up of good people, you're going to deal with it. But there's a reason why the government support services exist.
Yeah.
The charity sector can't provide all the support.
And people pay their taxes expecting to have their needs met should they become unwell.
Well, absolutely. Imagine the uprising if they suddenly decided, oh, we're cutting pensions. You've been paying in your whole life, and now that service that you've been expecting your whole life, we can't afford it, so we're not going
to. Well, they did that in Greece. They cut into pensions in Greece under austerity, and a report suggests that suicide has now increased by up to 40% when they did that. So
yeah,
it could happen.
Well, that's a really great example of the difference. And I've known of people personally through friends and family who have had benefits cut and have become suicidal or become more suicidal as a result of that. Luckily, I've not known anyone complete on a suicide in that way, but I know that it happens.
Yeah, but it's the whole process when you're not getting your financial needs met is humiliating. Mm-hmm. About 18 months after I came out of the hospital, I became poorly with anxiety to the point where I couldn't work. I'd nearly been evicted because I got mixed up with my bills, and I have a support worker to help me with that stuff now. But I got really stressed and had to get signed off for anxiety. And I was on working tax credits at the time to top up my earnings. And they said, you need to claim employment and support allowance. So I put in my claim for this. And of course, it takes many weeks. And while I was waiting for it, I had to visit the food bank three times because I was paying bedroom tax at that time as well. And I just didn't have enough. And it was humiliating. In Warsaw at that time, they told me that I could only go three times and for the food bank. And then on the third time I went, she literally went through all my finances with me. This, again, a stranger in the council office, and asked me, what do I spend my money on? And I'm like, well, I have a van and I have a dog. And she said to me, you should sell your van and you should get rid of your dog. I was just like so upset because I was temporarily unwell. I need my van for work. And my dog's like my only friend at home. I live by myself. So I had a panic attack in the council when that happened.
And I can completely understand why. These are your basic freedoms.
Yeah.
You'd never question other people about having a pet.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. You're not going to turn around someone rich and say, oh, you've got all this space, maybe have less pets and maybe, you know, have asylum seekers living with you, which would surely be in some way a logical thought experiment. But you could never imagine anyone in a higher position in society socioeconomically being asked these questions, being like, how can you justify having a pet? How can you justify having this much space? What are you spending your money on? Yet, because you're having to jump through all these hoops,
yeah,
it seems increasingly like the system is set up for people to fall through the cracks.
Yeah.
That the cost cutting becomes about how can we leave people behind? How can we make this so complicated that only a few people can actually figure it out?
Yeah, and I'm quite lucky in that I've learned a lot about politics from a campaign I got involved in. Mm-hmm. I got involved in a campaign called Sweets Way Resists. Up in London, people were fighting to save their social housing. Sadly, that campaign was lost and it's now Posh Flats, but I learned a lot from that campaign. Mm-hmm. So I know what my rights are, I know how to challenge them, I know how to articulate myself. But had I had some of the challenges before that campaign that I've had since them campaigns, I wouldn't have known how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have known how to fight back. I would have been like, okay, then right, I've got to move flat because I've got an extra bedroom. And of course, something like having to move can trigger an episode. And I was able to argue that I shouldn't need to move because it's stressful for having the spare bedroom. But they were trying to get me to leave my home, and I feel safe there. And, you know, who's to know if they put me in a different social housing, am I going to feel safe? Yeah, they are pushy, and we have, you know, we're supposed to have choices in a democratic society, but often I feel like I'm being dictated to by state officials and social workers, and I don't feel listened to, and I don't feel heard, and I don't feel understood.
Mm. Well, if you don't have the freedom to make basic decisions about what area you live with, whether or not you have a pet, then what separates these things between a democracy and a dictatorship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so frequently these cuts, as you rightly say, affect the most vulnerable people first, the people that need the support services first. Mm-hmm. And they often, not by coincidence, are those that have the most difficulty getting their voice heard.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're fighting for your own survival, are you going to have the free time or even energy to be campaigning for changes in government and things like this?
Yeah, exactly.
It seems like a systematic way of keeping people down.
Feels like they've almost done it on purpose because they know that we're isolated and they know that our mental health is low mood and we won't fight, but some of us do fight back. Breaks my heart, though. It really does.
Yeah. And as much as you have all this strength and are so brilliant for continuing through all these challenges, there are people that can't find that.
Yeah.
That it does become too much. And so we mentioned earlier suicide. It's one of those things that whilst I've not felt suicidal myself, I've had periods where I've known I'm going towards that, but luckily I've never got that bad.
Mm.
I can really understand in situations where all the control is taken away from you, where you feel you don't have any choice over your own existence, how that can start seeming like the only thing you might have control over.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mentioned earlier about my friend that I wrote a show about. His name was Tom Palmer.
Mm.
He was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and I met him on that campaign, The Sweet Sway Resists. And he didn't have his personal independence payments, and he was basically living homeless. He was a squatter. And I wanted to help him claim his benefits, and I know that he had problems with money and things like that. And I thought maybe if I could get him his benefits and into supported accommodation, he could be a bit better. But he ended up dying in 2016. He actually, we all believe that he was self-medicating. It was a heroin overdose. And he wasn't an addict. We've been through a very traumatic experience. Those of us that were part of the Sweet Sway campaign, it was a 7 months long political occupation where we were trying to save these homes. And then to lose that, and some activists got arrested and a disabled man was lifted out by bailiffs in his wheelchair, it was just horrible. I feel like he was probably trying to numb the pain because he wasn't getting his support needs met from the government that was supposed to be helping him. And people don't know what they're entitled to as well because of the language on some of the claim forms. You have to kind of really twist your brain to make yourself understood if your disability is mental or invisible, because the boxes that they want to tick are so black and white on those PIP assessment forms. And, you know, just looking at the form, you think, oh, well, this must be for physically disabled people. But it's supposed to be for everyone that has a long-term disability or health condition. I think they do that on purpose as well, so that people don't know what they're entitled to.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that makes me particularly sad, that the onus is constantly pushed onto the person that needs the support.
Mm.
Like, you're somehow expected to become basically an expert social worker without having any of the
pay or
any of the support.
Yeah, after my last appointment with Warsaw Council, I had to go home and read the Care Act, because I'm sure she was misquoting the Care Act to me. And I went home and I read it and I'm like, I'm sure I'm right, because it's legal language. I can't be sure. And when I challenged my PIP decision, I was lucky I got help from the Citizens Advice Bureau. They've since been cut a lot, I think, from Warsaw Council. They don't have the same amount of funding that they used to. So the cuts prevent people from getting the legal help that they need in challenging these decisions as well. But they're paying out massive money in the contracts to the private companies that execute the assessments, like Capita and Assos, when we already have professional opinion. We already have a doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they're saying, well, no, we're going to send this paramedic to assess you and just check that they're right. It doesn't make any sense. Why not just give it to the people directly? That's how we could save money.
Yeah, and we have the NHS is, you know, it's a public service.
Mm-hmm.
So surely the government would trust that and trust the professionals within it.
Some people hate the NHS, don't they? And they want it dismantled. I think the NHS is great. I think if healthcare is privatised, we become customers instead of patients, and there's no money in healthy people. They're going to want us sick.
And also the service will vary so wildly. You know, we know with whether you have like a hotel room, for example, how widely from like the worst hostel to like the five-star hotel, how widely that service differs. And it'll be the same with the beds in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have that range. You'll be in a bunk bed dealing with cancer because of the level of money you have rather than the level of need.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's a strange time we're living in, and
yeah,
you know, I'm so glad to hear your story just to shed light on it, because so often these experiences aren't heard.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I want to come back to what you said about homelessness and about the friend of yours who, it sounds like, fell through the cracks
yeah.
of the support system, became homeless. And it seems that in this country, homelessness is a way for services to write somebody off. That someone, once they become homeless, almost yeah. seems to stop existing.
Uh-huh.
Even living here in Birmingham, when I hear the stats on how many homeless people there are compared to how many I see,
uh-huh.
I wonder where they're getting this information.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't match at all. And there's, even within the public, there can be a lot of judgment when you mentioned about your friend self-medicating.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said that to me in the past, so, oh, I'm not going to give money to the homeless because they'll just spend it on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say to them, well, I think I'd probably spend it on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
If I was in that much of a, like, isolated and horrific
position. And you're freezing
position,
cold, like you wouldn't want to feel.
Yeah, and then there's people coming around on the streets that would give me something to numb the pain for a little bit.
Yeah.
I think I'd probably take it.
However, if they could choose to have a nice social housing and enough money to live and social support, they probably wouldn't need those drugs.
Yeah.
It's connected, mental health and addiction are connected, and there's a lot of stigma around mental health, but there's even more around addiction. But the two are interlinked.
Yeah, well, so often people want to blame those dealing with it.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't blame you for having a physical injury, and
yeah.
addiction is no more in control. And it's strange the way we have a kind of hierarchy of somebody that's addicted to cigarettes will judge somebody that's addicted to heroin, and it's like, well, I mean, it's just what you've been exposed to. If you can be addicted to one, you can probably be addicted to the other.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Did you hear about the Rat Park experiments?
Maybe. Could you explain that?
This is a really interesting experiment they did on rats. It kind of illustrates what I was just saying, like, had this person had their needs met. They had two parks for the rat, and one was just like a cage with nothing and no friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put another rat in a big play park cage with friends, and both rats had two bottles of water, and one was laced with cocaine. And they found out that the rat in the big play park that had all its needs met didn't drink the cocaine water, but the rat that was isolated with nothing just died. So there's
just overdosed.
Yeah, yeah. So there's, I feel, you know, that people are starting to connect the dots, and, you know, there's a lot of talk about privilege and how some people have better starts, and, you know, I'm a big advocate of equal ground and equal opportunity. And I think things like PIP and personal budgets enable people to have that equal ground. It's like, you know, it's like some people might need a walking stick to get around. Some people may need to, for example, pay a life coach to function and be social. And I feel, you know, giving them that choice is empowering for them.
Well, so often it's the awareness, isn't it?
Yeah.
We met at a Time to Change event recently, which was all about disability as a factor in mental health. And one of the speakers there, Jodie, mentioned about she's not fully blind, but she is registered blind.
Uh-huh.
So she is considered by the government to be blind, even though she can see partially. And so she has a stick that's a shorter version, so that people around her out and about can tell that she has difficulty seeing and make allowances.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's an example where people understand what that looks like. They understand the kind of support she needs.
Uh-huh.
And that's really what I think the gap is so frequently, it's just understanding.
Yeah, yeah. It's like people might see someone having a panic attack and think, oh God, what a brat. But then with a little bit of understanding, they might then see it as it's not just someone being a brat, it's someone that's had a trauma and they're reacting to past trauma in this moment because they've been triggered. But a lot of people can be very dismissive of people with mental health issues.
Yeah, for me, so much of that just comes back to the understanding and the stigma, because we see it differently even within mental health. Like bipolar that you experience, I think that one's more frequently stereotyped. There's this really reductive attitude that you are constantly high or low and constantly switching between the two.
Yeah.
And that's nothing more than a like cartoon version of it. That's not at all reality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at least some conditions like depression, people have at least a vague understanding. They understand what sadness is, and they understand how depression is similar but different.
Yeah.
But it's crazy how much, even within mental health, the understanding disparity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we are coming near the end of our time. I'm aware this has been quite a heavy episode and it's needed to be. These are such important issues. So you had something a bit more positive you were going to talk about now.
Yeah, there's a couple of positive things. One, I spoke about personalisation and personal budgets for social care. And although councils are tightening the reins on these, it seems it's part of the NHS's new plan to introduce more personalisation. So people will be able to get budgets from the NHS in the future, people with disabilities, I think it was something like 5 million people, or long-term health conditions, to have more choice over how their needs are met. So that's a positive thing that's happening, and I want to raise awareness of the choices that are available, because some people don't know. Also, I've got a project at the moment about mental health. I'm going to be talking to other artists about their experiences, and also some of the women that helped me with my recovery, including a life coach, a nutritionist, a aromatherapist, and a support worker, as part of a podcast. But you can find out about that from my website, lovemuffin.org.uk. And I am also writing a show at the moment called Covered, which is about getting your mental health needs met in austerity Britain. We're just going
good
to
fun
be
topic.
Yes, it's a comedy show. There are lots of jokes in it. You have to break up these sad stories with jokes, I think. But I'll be doing that at the Edinburgh Fringe and touring around the country up until then. So you can check out dates for that as well. Again, on lovemuffin.org.uk, and follow me on social media at Sammy Presti.
Great, that's really exciting. And I'd add to that something I've noticed as we've talked. There's a sort of continuing theme of how often it's individual campaigners and the public that are bringing up the awareness in lieu of government organisations doing it. So often it falls to charities and individuals to break down mental health stigma, and I'm really glad to be a part of that.
Yeah.
So another thing I'd recommend doing, just generally, if you want to take action having listened to this episode, is take a look at change.org, which is where many petitions, including ours, are hosted. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few high profile mental health petitions. If you even just search mental health, you'll find them. And in particular, there's been one of those earlier in the year that led to a minister for suicide prevention being appointed in the government. So there are changes happening, and so often they're coming from the public demand. So if we keep demanding the support, it can make a difference. And whether it affects you or not, there's going to be people that, depending what they're going through, won't have the power to be political at this point.
Yeah.
And so you're also taking part in these kind of campaigns. It's for those that can't as well. It's being the voice for those that are voiceless.
Exactly. And then there's the Time to Change movement as well.
Yeah, we're
where
both
I met
part.
You.
Indeed, we should definitely mention them. We're both part of Time to Change, which is a campaign all around breaking down stigma. And you can just Google them to find out all about the wonderful work they do.
Yay.
All right. So we'll finish up there. Thank you so much for being
part
of the episode.
It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thanks, Sammy. And I'll put a few of your links down in the description as well.
Cool. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.